Blog Talk Radio.
A radio with the guts. It was on the second floor on Coronado Street. I used to get drunk and throw the radio through the window while it was playing. And of course, it would break the glass in the window, and the radio would sit out there on the roof, still playing. And I'd tell my woman, "Ah, what a marvelous radio." The next morning, I take the window off the hinges and carry it down the street to the glass man, who had put in another pane. I kept throwing that radio through the window each time I got drunk, and it would sit out there on the roof, still playing, a magic radio, a radio with guts. And each morning, I take the window back to the glass man. I don't remember how it ended exactly, though I do remember we finally moved out. There was a woman downstairs who worked in the garden in her bathing suit, and her husband complained he couldn't sleep nights because of me. So we moved out, and in the next place, I either forgot to throw the radio out the window, or I didn't feel like it anymore. I do remember missing the woman who worked in the garden in her bathing suit. She really dug with that trowel, and she put her behind up in the air. I used to sit in the window and watch the sun shine all over that thing while the music played.
Hello, and welcome to Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet. That was a poem I had on CD collection by Charles Bukowski. I think it's called like The Radio with Guts or something. But while we're waiting for our guest to call in, I'll just let us know that next week our guest will be Brian Fugier of Zygote My Coffee Press. And the week after will be Bill Gaynor. So I think the week after that's S.A. Griffin. So we got some good shows lined up. But tonight our guest is out of New York City area, is George Wallace. I think he's, waiting for him to call in, but it's George Wallace, and he's a Walt Whitman writer in residence and a damn fine poet who's read and published all over the damn world. One day I see him in, like, England and Rome, and the next day I see him in California. So, you know, I had the honor of reading with him in around Hartford, Connecticut, three or four years ago, and it was an excellent time, but I think this is him calling in, so we'll just bring him on air now. George?
It is. It's George. Frank.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good, good. Where is this that you're, where is this area code? You're in North Dakota?
No, this area code is for the, it's the Blog Talk Radio thing, switchboard.
Yeah.
It's different from my area code. It works like in like some like this toll free capacity that like you call in.
She's got a great voice. She's got a British accent.
Oh yeah. yeah. She comes on at the end of the show on my phone to remind me the show's over, and I got 30 seconds left with her.
She's an actual human being. She's not like a GPS person.
I don't know. She might be a GPS person. I've never seen her or anything. How's the state of New York this evening?
Oh, it's incredible. What a show. We've had some acts of pure grace around here, you know. Some people have really been torn apart by the storm. Some people are stepping up to the plate, helping other people. There's a lot of turmoil where things are not getting done fast enough. Me, I hunkered down and turned it into a romantic interlude. It was like going camping in the Great North Woods.
So you weren't
no electricity.
So where you live? Sorry, go ahead.
What's that? Yeah. Oh, so it was real nice. I mean, you know, sit by the fire and tell ghost stories and go to bed by candlelight. It was pretty romantic, I thought.
Yeah, hey, no, that's not bad at all. It's a good way to get through a hard time. So what have you been up to? Are you traveling around or?
Well, I was in Lowell, Massachusetts for the Kerouac Festival in October, the annual festival. I went up for a couple of days there. Aside from that, I pretty much stay in the New York area, you know, during the semester because I do a little bit of teaching. I got an adjunct gig in the city, so I do that. My big travels this summer were to Kansas and Oklahoma, that area, and of course I did get a chance to travel down to Southern California to Napomo to do a workshop down there. So I had a lot of good trips recently.
Oh, that's great, man. That's great. So why don't you start us off with a poem and we'll take it from there.
I got a poem that I wrote when I was in Kansas, which, by the way, is an incredible place. I mean, I studied up on it because Walt Whitman went there when he was in 1879. He was an older dude, and he said some really cool things about Kansas and the prairies and how the true American voice is going to come out of the Midwest. And, you know, sure enough, I think bebop jazz and abstract expressionism and different movements like that really did have their origins in Kansas City and that area. So I think he had, you know, a pretty good point to make about that. Anyway, I wrote this poem, Belt Buckles and Bibles. Johnny Chisholm wandered clear across the high prairies selling Bibles and belt buckles. It was a long time ago, and he was not a preaching man, no sir, just a fella like you or me trying to make his way through this lonesome world, do a service to society, and feed a family besides. But how's bells could that boy sell? 6 months into that little operation of his, the sun rose and fell on Johnny Chisholm's buckles that danced from belt to belt across the high prairie to the state line in finer stormy weather. One time he sold a half a dozen Bibles to some chickens, and soon after that there was a rebirth of faith and decent expectations in every town and crossroads in this country, and the commutation of naked souls is back on the table, because as we all know, there's only two things a man needs if he aims to please his wife and maintain his dignity. It's a belt buckle and a Bible. And anyhow, whether you agree with what Johnny Chisholm was selling or not, it just didn't seem to pay no mind to the people of Kansas, because a healthy dose of free enterprise and an ample supply of natural charm was all we ever seemed to need or was looking for. And ever since that boy walked out into this world, the farmers and the cattlemen and the bankers and the townsfolk of this great land has had two things that they can agree on, stand up for, praise on Sunday, and hang their hats on, not to mention keep their britches up with in a dust storm or during a state or local election. And that's Bibles and belt buckles.
Oh, wow, man. That was excellent. So you were mentioning the whole Walt Whitman thing. How did this Walt Whitman writer in residence stuff come about?
Oh, well, you know, I live just a couple of miles away from the Walt Whitman birthplace, you know, here in Huntington, Long Island, West Hills, Long Island. And over the years, you know, I've done a lot of things in poetry, including organizing some events with them. And including every year I would hang out with the poet in residence, and these are like the heavies, you know, like Yevtushenko and Allen Ginsberg and Diane Rakosky and Sharon Olds, and all these people would come through, and I would get to spend a little bit of time with them, Robert Bly, you know, eat some Chinese food with them and interview them. So I got to be like a fixture over there in a way. And then one day this position opened up. They asked me what I would do, if I had some ideas to do it. And I said, yeah, I would start this reading series one in-house, and I would also become like an ambassador for the birthplace and bring programs to other places around the country to make connections. So that's what I've done. I've done it for 2 years. I've been to John Steinbeck Center in Salinas, and I was at the Gordon Parks Museum in Kansas, and Woody Guthrie Festival I do. I've been to England and Scotland, to the Robbie Burns Center, and just like, it's a lot of opportunities. And it's very exciting.
Yeah, it sounds very exciting. You're doing all kinds of like amazing things like out there, and that's really cool. Like, I don't know. Yeah, that's great. So do you have any like projects coming now, or are you just busy traveling and writing like any new books or anything? Or
I've got books that keep coming out. I keep trying to find ways to do something with them. But, you know, they come out in limited editions, so a small quantity come out, and you have a book party, and before you know it, you only got a half a dozen left, so I don't really know how to do it. Yeah, if I was really published by some major company that was investing in it and sending me around to sell the thing, then that would be one thing. But, you know, basically a book comes out, I throw a book party, and half of the books are gone. So 2 or 3 times after that, and I've got to keep a couple copies just so I've got some, you know, to stroke and pet, you know, in my late in the night. So I don't know what to do with books, but I do have a lot of projects going on right now. I'm working up this idea about the connection between Bop prosody, you know, like Jack Kerouac's prose and Allen Ginsberg's poetry, and jazz, bebop jazz. And, you know, what's in that, which is an indigenous American sort of a thing, a special sort of a voice.
Nice, man.
Yeah, so I've been working that. And I gave a presentation on that this summer, actually, at the Jackson Pollock's place out in the Hamptons, out in Springs. It's the Pollock Krasner House, where he, you know, you ever see any movies about Jackson Pollock where he's, you know, he's out in the country? And
yeah,
paint, and there's like a guy actually filming him from underneath this plastic. Yeah, so that's the house that I went out to. And
nice, man. That's cool.
Yeah. Oh,
so,
well, it's real cool. You know, I mean, it's like there's all these great associations. When we speak, we think that we're speaking with a solo voice, but we're speaking with a whole, you know, a whole chorus of voices that brought us to this point. And finding those voices and identifying them is a wonderful thing to experience for a writer.
Yeah, and that's kind of leads me to my next question in a way. It's kind of like the small world that this actually becomes from anywhere around the world, because I think you just did a workshop last summer at my cousin's ranch in California or something.
That's right, That was a great, it was a weekend retreat, and we had people come in from, well, pretty much from L.A. and from the local area, that's in the Central Coast area. We had one or two come down from San Francisco. I was hoping you would come.
Oh, yeah, she offered me to go. She's like, you can lounge around in the pool.
Yeah.
I wanted to, but,
yeah.
You know.
She's very generous. She's wonderful. Your cousin's wonderful. She's also a good poet. And she was here in New York not too long ago, but that was the same weekend I was in Lowell, so I missed her. But she's very talented, very ambitious, and you come from a very very productive family. So, I mean, you've got good creds, man. You got good genes.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, actually, she's like cousin by marriage, but it's all the same thing. Like, her sister's been married to my uncle since I was born, so we're all the same thing, I suppose.
Oh,
but,
right.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't you just lead into another poem, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, all right. Is this a no curse zone, or can I?
Oh no, you can curse all the hell you want.
I got this kind of an odd poem about a filmmaker from a young guy named Junior Kaufman from one of the boroughs of New York City. It's called Junior Kaufman. Could have been a great movie maker. A great damn movie maker. He could have been a great movie maker. He could have been the next Eisenstein or Woody Allen. He could have put George Lucas to shame. He ever made a movie, that is, which he never did make a movie. He just sat around naked in his room writing haiku while his parents fretted and fumed downstairs. They said things like, he's a pretty good haiku writer for an American boy living on Suffern Boulevard in Queens, a pretty good haiku maker. Even his teacher thought so, always the right number of syllables. 17. His haiku had nature in them, plenty of nature and seasons and a big fat Zen slap in the face, the whole nine yards. Imagine if he applied all that talent to film, said his dad, until one day, while Junior Kaufman was sleeping, a spider came into his room and it climbed up onto his pillow and it bit him on the nose. And then everything went south. Which is to say, Junior Kaufman became a little nervous. He got a little strange. He started to get the syllable count wrong. He neglected to mention the seasons. He also became, shall we say, somewhat scatological. What's the parent to do in a situation like that in America, land of the free, home of the ad hominem? But the kid's so smart, said Dad, so they left it alone. They let it be. And the more Junior Kaufman wrote, the filthier his haiku became, until before very long, every one of Junior Kaufman's haiku was full of shit, piss, and erectile dysfunction. Oh, and nipples. So many nipples running around inside Junior Kaufman's head, it was as if you or me, we would probably go nuts. How did he keep it all under control? What was his secret? The way they tell it around here, they say reading a Junior Kaufman haiku was worse than having to go through puberty a second time. But those haiku had to be written. They had to come out. His parents didn't get it. They didn't understand it, even though they respected his art. What goes faster than the speed of light, wrote Junior Kaufman. Little Light's kid sister, but she's got no tits. Well, they were dealing with a great filmmaker in a little boy's bedroom who additionally had been bitten on the nose by a spider. Well, I certainly do not know what to do, said his mother, but this shit has simply got to stop. Well, they coddled him. They punished him. His mother made him soup. His father whacked him a good one and then took him to see the Mets. They even considered a shrink, but it was no use. There was no cure for it. Junior Kaufman's illness had become a force of nature. It could not be contained. So they locked little Junior Kaufman away in his room upstairs, and they threw away the key. This is all many years ago. But to this day, some people say if you listen carefully late at night, you can hear someone scratching out scatological haiku in Junior Kaufman's secret bedroom on Suffern Boulevard in Queens. And someone ought to petition the borough president to put a stop to it. Either that, or install a big plaque that reads, Junior Kaufman, the Albert Einstein of nipple haiku, lived here. Because maybe that's what it's going to take to shut that little bastard up.
Wow, man, that was fucking great, dude. Yeah, that is there like a backstory to that, or is that I missed the first part. I don't know if you told me the first part where you might have known him, or is that like?
Ah, I just made the cat up.
Oh, that's fun. That's cool. Yeah, that's great, man. That was awesome.
I think that every town's got a few Junior Kaufmans in it. Could have been great movie makers, but they get bit on the nose. They end up becoming just like, weird kids upstairs that never come out.
Yeah, I think like I really liked it because when I was talking about the haikus, I picture myself sometimes going through the agony of trying to write them myself.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm scratching at those ceilings or whatever too. But yeah. So So when did all this come about? Have you always been a fan of poetry since like a kid, or did it come about later in life?
Poetry. Well, you know, I was a musician when I was a kid. I got a lot of I got a lot of satisfaction out of being a musician. Not so much like the classical stuff. And I was like, I studied classical music, and but I was never happy with my actual execution of it. You know, people were saying, "Oh, George is all that," but I never thought I really was. I mean, I didn't enjoy it until somebody, you know, a friend of mine, Kip Carman, said, "Come on, let's get this this Hammond organ out of your house and put it on the road." And he made me a backup guy in an R&B band. And then I had fun with it for, you know, until I graduated from high school and went off to college. You know, but actually it was when I went off to college that I didn't, you know, I didn't have the instruments anymore. So I took up writing just to replace, you know, the music.
And it's just been with you ever since. Do you play music anymore? Is it just something you
I'm sort of a natural in that, you know, I was reading music before I was reading writing at the age of four. So, I mean, I can go to a keyboard at any time and you know, knock something out real easy, improvise something or cover some tune, you know. But I only do it for myself, you know, just to fool around, because, you know, I get so much more satisfaction out of manipulating words. And there's so much energy. They give back more than individual notes give back to me.
Yeah, that reminded me of something I heard that Gregory Corso said when he said lyricists or musicians, so to speak, are the court jester, as a poet is considered like the king's right-hand man or something like that. I might have been paraphrasing, but something around there.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is that, I mean, there's so much potential energy. There's so much life and complexity in words, with the connotation and when you combine them together, the meaning and what they suggest, there's a lot more to work with, you know. A word or a series of words coming together in the construction of it is a very, very exciting process, and then re-encountering them when you actually read them out loud is revisiting all that energy that went into that interaction. And that's the big thing to me, is the interaction. You know, is that I'm not writing a poem by myself. The words are involved. The words are involved in the writing because they have something to contribute. I may say, "I want you to do this," but they say, no, this is also going on, and I have to listen to the words. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
It sounds phony, but I mean, it's really true. The words are very, you know, they're very insistent.
Nice. So, is that like when you found that love for words? Was it like, say, when you discovered Walt Whitman or something like that? Like, because when I first discovered him, his words just jumped off the page in like some giant song.
I came to Walt Whitman late, you know, because I wasn't reading for that projective rhythm, you know, when I was younger. I was reading much too much for, like, from my intellect. I wasn't reading from the heart. I wasn't reading from the throat. You know, Whitman's writing is oratorical. It's meant to be shouted. It's meant to be, you know, to be said boldly as you're walking through a forest with your shirt off. You know? and so until I was ready to be that person, I wasn't ready for Whitman. So it wasn't until I was that kind of a person that I could really walk with Whitman.
That's great, no, man. It's a good way to put it, walking through the woods with your shirt off, man. Like, I totally understand that, the way that you put that. That's actually a damn quotable line, if you ask me.
Well, you know, Actually, I'm referring to a poet here on Long Island who actually grew up almost like within rock throwing distance of the Walt Whitman birthplace. A very fine poet who used to do that. He used to walk through the woods like that. And he's who I got the idea from. But it's that boldness. It's that boldness and assertiveness and uncompromising assertiveness that Whitman's really got. You have to be able to have that, not the ego arrogance, but the confidence, in voice and the value of voice, to be able to carry that off and to be able to love it. I had a lot of resistance to Whitman at first because I was like, what kind of egomaniac is this guy? And he's not an egomaniac at all, because I didn't understand transcendentalism. I didn't understand when he was talking about his being and everything being in him. It wasn't about him. It's about you, and it's about me, and it's about all of existence and its connections, the connection between things. He had that vision, and that vision is non-ego vision.
Nicely put, man.
As an American, as a young American, you have to get past your own struggles with ego in order to be able to walk that walk.
And I think that's like a good way to what writing has done for me is helped to begin with in the last 2 or 3 years, even like to eliminate the ego, to be able to guide myself into doing something like that. So I totally understand what you're talking about. That's a good way to put it. And I don't know.
Between humility and timidness. Humility is not being timid. Humility is being at the same tonal pitch as who you are as a connected human being. If you understand your connection to other things and that spark that's in everything, then you don't have to hide that under a basket at all. You can shout that out. You can shout that out.
Yeah, and it's extremely hard for, I think, a lot of people, not just artists, but people in general, to connect with that. I find it hard to do myself, but there are times when you can see it and realize it. I mean, I don't know. That's my journey, but.
It's easy to go like, oh, Whitman is 19th century and is naive. He's got this 19th century naivete. He's like so totally positive. I mean, where is his social consciousness? He didn't go through, the stuff that Steinbeck writes about. He didn't go through existentialism and Dadaism and, all the things of the 20th century. But it's possible to see, and that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about Bob Prosody and the way that Ginsberg, Ginsberg and Sunflower Sutra is a modern version, an informed, a modern, mid to late 20th century Whitmanic voice. It's not a 19th century naive voice. It's a voice that says, yes, I've seen this. I've seen the corrosion. And yet there's something deeper inside, there's something clean inside, and I can celebrate that. Whitman celebrates himself without any compunction. Ginsberg has to dust all that crap off the sunflower to do it, but then he celebrates himself.
Yes, that's great. That's nicely put, man. Those are like good words, good choices. Do you want to lead into another poem? We're at the halfway point. If anybody out there in listening world wants to call in and ask George a question, feel free to do so. All right, you can read another poem if you want.
Oh, yeah, good. I got this poem I wrote actually the day that the hurricane was coming into New York area. I was downtown and I wrote this poem at lunchtime. It's called Beer and Sausages Go Better. Beer and sausages go better when you're waiting for Hurricane Sandy to come. It's 12 o'clock Monday morning below Pearl Street, and men in hard hats are pouring cement into a hole under the watchful eye of an urban archaeologist who's wearing a fluorescent yellow flak jacket, carrying a clipboard, and shooing away a couple of pigeons. A plane passes between skyscrapers, but the archaeologist is paying attention to the construction crew, which is ankle-deep in a slurry of cement after having shot straight down a chute and into a steaming pool at their feet. They're hard at it, too. There's a shovel man in suspenders. There's a dude with a red bandana spreading it all out with the flat end of a rake. They're in a hurry because the storm's coming soon. They need to knock off work, and now here comes a smoothing man with his bristled broom. His job is to make those seams disappear. Up at the campus, the business majors are memorizing Malthus for their 1 o'clock, and I know this street will be underwater soon when the East River comes up and the electricity goes down. And when night comes, it won't be safe to be out on the street unless you're one of the gangbangers, which I'm not. But this too shall pass. The river will return to its banks. The bright lights of New York City will return. Morning will come, and the men in hard hats will return and reset the street with round cobblestones for European tourists and safari coats and Midwestern tourists and T-shirts and high-heeled women with rich boyfriends and business suits to walk on. But for now, it's just this crew of working men in a big hurry and me and this sausage roll, mustard on my hands and a half bottle of good Belgian beer between my knees. 12:35 and a storm named Sandy's churning up the coast like a cement mixer full of piss and vinegar, ready to steal this pale, peaceful October New York City morning away.
Oh, wow, man. Excuse me. Yeah, that was great. Were you actually eating sausages and drinking Belgian beer just beforehand, or
yeah, Frank O'Hara used to go out and he wrote lunch poems. He'd go out every day. He was sort of midtown. So I figured I'd go try that. And, you know, at lunchtime I went down to just a block or two away from South Street Seaport and I wrote the notes for this.
Nice. That's some good stuff, man. This question. When I started writing, I didn't start till late. You know, I always used to write when I was a kid, but for some reason in my 20s, I just stopped it altogether. Maybe I wasn't ready. And then when I started in my early 30s, or when I was 30, I had come into contact because of the wide world web of people like Scott and SA and you and Dan.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to meet you guys. And then...
Yeah.
And, like, I learned something from everybody because I was always, though I went through those drunk years a while back, I still in tune and listened. You always seem to travel and never stick with one certain group. And it's kind of something that I've done. I never, like, stick to one group. I find meeting all kinds of different people. Have you always been that way, just kind of bebopping all over the world with all kinds of different people?
Well, we got a crowd here. I mean, we got a real good crowd of people here and, you know, in New York that I'm with, I got a crew in New York.
Yeah,
you know, but,
yeah.
But I think that, you know, we live in a real special time. I don't know how long it's going to last, but we live in a very special time in terms of communication. And I want to take advantage of that. You know, I remember back before the internet, and that's not so many years ago, I was like, you know, the problem with poetry in America is that it's top down. You know, it's like, you know, there's like this some elite, and they're telling us this is what's good and this is what's important and this is what you need to be paying attention to. And I said, well, we should be more like the Chinese and have bottom up. You know, have like a real democratic, little deep democratic, little pockets of things happening all over the country, people writing and sharing their work, and it should percolate from the bottom up. Not get handed down to us from, you know, from the University of Iowa or someplace like that. Well, so I tried it. You know, I got a couple people, and I managed to find somebody in Woodstock, you know, Bill Seaton, who had a reading series up there, and it took like weeks and months to find this and put something together. And finally, you know, I took a trip up to Woodstock and did a reading there with two or three of the local people from around here. We did the thing, and I said, now you guys, you come down and, you know, do something with us in New York. And I was like, yeah, right. But it was like 6 months to a year to make something like that happen before the Internet, before social media. Now, I mean, I'm setting up gigs all over, all over the country and places in Europe and even possibilities in Australia, and it's right in front of me. While I'm talking to you, I've got the screen in front of me, and I've got access to people that are doing things. So we now have a possibility of networking in a way that was not possible. So, damn, this is our chance. This is our chance to band together as small groups of writers all over the country and share and experience things together. That's a beautiful thing to me. That breaks the bonds.
No, yeah, that's definitely good. And because I ask that question a lot, especially to people who are before the internet or around in the 70s and 60s and were in the small press, and a lot of them say the same thing, that it was hard to get together unless you lived in a New York City or Los Angeles. You know, you couldn't like do it so much out in the Midwest, and there's so much good talent in the Midwest. You know, I think it's definitely a positive.
Hell yeah, I'm in Kansas City, that Prospero's Books, what a great bookstore, the really good writers there. You know, it was a good place to hang, and there's places like that all over the country. There's places like that all over the country. Cleveland's got a great scene going on. You know, Chicago does. Detroit does. I mean, there's places all over this country where people are doing good stuff. And now we're finally getting a chance to see that. So, I mean, no longer is it by, you know, that God hands down to Billy Collins, you know, the divine authority, and then he spreads that to his minions the way that he wishes to. You know, it doesn't have to be that way anymore, because those people are just dancing on the head of a needle. You know, on the head of a pen. That's a tiny, you know, economy that they're living on. And if you know, but we're doing in the trenches, in the local towns and local cities, we're doing the real work of poets. We're speaking as poets in every city across America. You know, whether that ever gets commodified or not, I don't know. And whether it should get commodified or not, I don't know. Maybe you know, if it did get commodified and turned into something that people could make money on, it would ruin it. Maybe it's best that there's just people that are that are having a good damn time writing and sharing their work with each other. And that's the goal. Yeah. You woke up in the morning and you're a poet. And you're in a community of poets, and you got to do that your whole life. That's a win, as far as I'm concerned.
No, I agree. The mind changes when you're able to give up the huge ego of trying to make $1 million off of it, because it ain't gonna happen. Do you want to go into a poem?
You want me to read something else? You want me to read something else?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, this redhead of my son acquaintance. Well, what I mean to say, the road was straighter than this. I was driving unreasonably fast. It was a 57 Chrysler Imperial. You remember those, maybe. Well, maybe you don't. But, man, well, you know, it was cherry red. It was souped up, electric window, electric top, chrome grill, big damn fins, but it didn't have any brakes. There was no brakes. You had to scuffle your feet along. It would take you 3 miles rolling. There's rocks flying everywhere. You might need a new pair of shoes if you wanted to stop. Anyhow, I couldn't afford tires, as my situation, concisely speaking, was dire, if not to say extreme. But being that it was, I could, of course, have gone around the corner, that is to say, steal something secondhand. But at the time, I was with this redhead of my sudden acquaintance, well-positioned in town. She with a well-oiled boyfriend, and me with plenty of time on my hands. But no, he wasn't in tow on that particular morning. In fact, she'd been sitting in a booth at the diner a very long time, by the appearance of things, a very long time. Coffee, cups, there's ashtrays full of nervous cigarettes. She was putting her hairpins into and out of her hair. Well, I struck up a conversation. It got to be this, got to be that, and everything was going along pretty damn fine. And when I looked outside, as sure as we're sitting here today, it had stopped raining. Morning was nearly over. The cat was out of the bag, so zippity-doo, we was off. Both of us shot out of the barrel, and that was that. No doubt was traveling 10 times faster than what's legal. I'm talking 35 plus 35 plus 35, and that some, and was, yes, man, I mean, not on that road outside of Fort Collins. I prefer at this late stage to say it was one of them back east, headed for her hometown in Kansas, because she was a school teacher of good repute, you might say. There was not a cop car to be seen. The breeze was everything. Eastern Colorado was a sight to see. She was smart, and with that orange sky, no, not like the red in her hair, a coppery sort of red, like Lincoln's pipe on a new shiny penny. She gave me the prettiest smile just then, boy. Boy, you could just feel it. That car wanted to fly, and we rolled down the window, and we beat to the beat on the dash. Oh, my, she said. Oh, my, she said. My right toenail, oh, my, I do believe it has just had an emotion.
Wow, man. That was good, man. That made me feel happy.
Well, good.
That was good. So, what if, like, we do have listeners, I can see that, but usually they don't ever call in anyways, but they all get shy. We have, like, a lot of people listening to the show and archiving. I can't believe it. I did this show as a way to give back to the Muse for, like, a year, and we've had, like, 3,000 listeners a month, which is pretty good for an underground. Yeah, so. But,
oh, heaven, if anybody wants to call in, I'll take it. Come on.
Yeah,
you got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, if you if people wanted to find out more about George Wallace and his works and stuff, how would they do that?
Oh, yeah, Google me. George Wallace poetry. Just Google
me. That works.
I'm on YouTube, I'm on Facebook, my stuff's a lot of places. So, just Google George Wallace poetry, you'll find me.
Straightforward answer. That's probably the most straightforward answer I've had since doing the show last April.
What's a better answer? I can't think of any other answer.
No. That works, man. That works because it's true. Again, the magic of the World Wide Web. Google Frank Reardon poetry and find my book. Like, find out where we're at. But I think it's a good thing. Like what you were talking about earlier, bringing the community together. Well, I'm doing my short stint here. I hope we're getting out of North Dakota next year after this horrendous winter, but this little show gives me a way to give back, I suppose. It connects people. It keeps me connected while I'm doing my time up here like a prison. But
you're doing important work there. I mean, I'm here in New York where everybody's, not quite as bad as San Francisco. You know, they say that in San Francisco you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a poet. So it's not quite as bad as that in New York. But you're in the belly of the beast. You can make some real headway there in North Dakota. I don't know what it's like and how much of a challenge it is, but you've got there's a lot of fertile ground there for you to be subversive.
Yeah, we're up in why not, my not, freezing's the reason.
That sounds jingoistic and Air Force-like.
Yeah, it is. We've got snow on the ground, and it is 10 degrees or low, minus 20 last night.
Oh,
yeah, I can tell I'm approaching 40 because I can't handle the cold snow anymore.
Oh, yeah, but actually, shoveling's good for you.
Yeah.
I got a couple of trees I got to cut up. I'll tell you what. If anybody wants to call, they got a chainsaw and can help me with, cut up a couple of trees. Have them email me. at poetrybay at AOL.com. P-O-E-T-R-Y-B-A-Y. Yeah. If you're in the New York area, you got a chainsaw and want to help me cut up a couple of trees, I'll give you, you know, I'll buy a couple of drinks afterwards.
Wow, you can't go wrong there. So yeah, do you want to, I know we're down here to the last 10 minutes or so, so do you want to, like, send us out with another poem?
Oh, yeah, I'll give you one more poem, yeah.
Yeah, go for it.
I'll give you my Garbage Man poem. It's a New York poem. Well, by the way, in that last poem, Fort Collins, I mentioned, I've actually stuck that in there because of Jason Harding, who's a friend of yours.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten that yet, one of these days. This poem is called I Want to Go Where the Garbage Men Go. I want to ride where the garbage men ride. It's Friday night. It's 8 p.m. I want to go where the garbage men go. When they gear up, when they get in motion, the garbage men, cruising the city like a shooting star, like a desert consuming itself. They ache for garbage from their biceps to their toes, like Columbus ached for America, like kids ache for the Good Humor Man, like a robber emptying a cash register at a 7-Eleven aches for cash. In T-shirts and stained jeans with their jaws stuck out like Ethel and Fred Mertz and their head like steel plates and their va-va-va-boom. The garbage men do not mind. They do not care. It's hot. It's cool. What's the difference? It's all work to them. They love to work with their leather gloves on their leather hands, and they are high above the crowd and the stench of it all. And it's good damn money besides. It's good damn money. Who's going to tell them different? They're tall. They're muscular. Who's going to tell them? They have good teeth, they have hair like Greek gods, and their language is perfect. Their muscles shivering like primitive seas, their bones shaking like javelins, and the blood of centuries dries on their hands, and their biggest beer barrels, and they love to talk like pirates of the Aegean and wrestle with each other like animals on the ground. Their jackhammers in Mamaroneck, their tugboats on the Sound, from Brooklyn to the Bronx, from trash can to sea to shining sea. I want to roll along on the rain-spattered roadway. I'm perfectly serious about this. I want to go with the garbage men. They're calm, they're professional, they're loud as fist striking solid steel. They're polite to the mayor, and if they whistle at the pretty mamacitas, it's only for show. It doesn't really mean anything. They brush flies away from their faces. Nothing bothers them. Nothing at all. Not traffic lights, not fender benders, not bosses, not banana skins, not razor blades, not $20 bills, not a box of taco shells, not the daily news. And when the wind picks up, they shout back at the wind, and the wind gets the hell out of their way. And when they wave to the driver, the truck takes off, and the traffic parts like mountains part for Colorado mountain men, and they ride away. And where do they go? With all that garbage, they go to the landfill, they go to the loading docks, they go to the trailer parks, they go to Windy Gap, they go to the incinerator, they go to Staten Island, they go to the ocean floor. They go home to their wives and mothers, their sons and daughters, to their neat little houses and their neat little suburbs. They climb out of their trucks and they pull off their clothes and they climb into their beds and they pull their wives to them and they make love to their wives properly. And then they go to sleep. And if they dream at all, it's no big thing. No big thing. After a while, they stop dreaming and they're dead to the world. And their sleep is dark and perfect, as night is dark and perfect. And they are the lords of everything they survey.
Damn, man. What was that line towards them? Was it say, if they dream, it doesn't really matter? What was that line?
Oh, after they make love to their wives properly, they go to sleep, and if they dream at all, it's no big thing, no big thing. After a while, they stop dreaming, they're dead to the world, and their sleep is dark and perfect as night is dark and perfect. And the Lord is everything.
That's great, man. That's a that's like a the powerful ending. Yeah, that was great. So what is the, I know I kind of touched on it at the very beginning of the show, but what's the future holding for George Wallace?
I'm involved in some good projects here in New York. I'm helping to edit Great Weather for Media with Jane Ormerod and Thomas Fucalora and Russ Green. The first issue came out of that, and real pleased about that. It's an edgy sort of a publication, and right now Jane's in Southern California moving the book around and showing it off a few places. So that's a good project I'm involved in. I do travel to the United Kingdom almost every year. I didn't go this year, but I have an extensive trip planned to do a week-long workshop on the Isle of Arran, that's off the coast of Scotland, and to meet with the Whitman people in Bolton. There's some people that have been devotees of Whitman since the turn of the century in England, and there's a little society of them, so I'm going to go visit them. And a couple of other projects with Geraldine Green, a good friend from England, another very fine poet. So, you know, there's a lot of good projects in England this coming summer.
Right on. That sounds good.
Well, I'll tell you, I'd love to get back and learn more about the midsection, the Midwest. I really dug Kansas. You know, I know there's a lot more for me to experience. I mean, in Illinois and Missouri, and the world just keeps getting bigger. The more
you
gets.
Where in Kansas were you at, Lawrence, or?
I was in the southeast Kansas, which is like, it was an old progressive radical area. You know, it's Osawatomie. That's where John Brown, the John Brown raids were. Teddy Roosevelt spoke there about new progressivism. That guy who financed the undercover work, which became Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. He's a publisher from southeastern Kansas. So I spent a lot of time down there with Al Ortolani, a very good poet from that area, from Pittsburgh, Kansas. So I was in Pittsburgh, I was in Fort Scott, I was in Kansas City pretty much. And I spent a couple of days in the Flint Hills, in the Tall Grass Prairie area, you know, which was, to me, an unbelievable experience. It really changed my view of the world.
Yeah, I lived out in Kansas City for about 4 months and a few years back. And I used to hang down at Prospero's with Reberg and Iris and all them people. And it was definitely a good experience. Like, I mean, of course, the few readings we had out there, but
I mean, that bookshop of theirs is a fabulous bookshop, Prospero's. And, you know, you get across the other side of it, maybe that's on the same side, you know, to 18th and Vine, and there's some excellent jazz going down. Jazz going down in that town. You know, I like the town a lot.
Yeah, they've got down on, I think it's the streets you're talking about. I forgot the name of the place, but it doesn't open till midnight, like 11 o'clock at midnight, and it's open till like 6 in the morning across from B.B. King's or something like that. And
Yeah, for me as a New Yorker, I mean, you know, I've got this myopic New York thing, you know, that this is the center of the universe. But you know, there's all sorts of cultural overlays, you know, in Kansas City that are really powerful and different from here. And it's not just like some other town. You've got all the New Orleans stuff that's come up. You've got all the cowboy stuff that's gone. You've got all the railroad stuff that's come through. You know, so I mean, it really has created its own flavor, a real strong flavor of its own. You know, and that was something that I learned more than anything else about visiting Kansas City. Is that there's places in this country that are not just cow towns and they're not just like backwaters. They're places that are rich. They're rich in voice. They're rich in personality. They're just different from this particular voice. I insist on going out and experiencing it. I'm greedy for that experience. It's like I'm discovering places on my tongue with new flavors that I didn't even know were there. That's how much I love to go to new places.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me like why I lived in northern Alabama for 5 years. I mean, besides that, my daughter lives there, but like it's a hard place to like. If you go to like places like Huntsville or Muscle Shoals, where that music scene is all up in there, it's got a lot to it, and there's a lot of like great artists there. Not everything is like
backwoods trailer park stuff. Like, you know, all the Midwest and southern part of the country's got a lot of heritage and history to it that speaks to you.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, to me, there's a rich harvest beyond, you know, for an artist. There's such a rich harvest out there beyond anybody's ability to spread your arms around it and gather it up. So, I mean, that I'm so excited to be alive and to be able to get out there and experience it. And I don't want it to end. I don't want it to end. You know, when I was a kid, first started to travel, I had like this world map. I don't know, you're probably running out of time, but I had this world map and I was like putting pins in the map, you know, like have I been here, have I been there, you know, and all the places I'd been. And it was pretty cool. I kind of dug on that, you know, but it got to the point that I was like, I'm never going to get to Tierra del Fuego. You know, I'm never going to get to Greenland. And so, like, the whole map, like, most of the map I would never get to. I got very frustrated, and I stopped traveling. I stopped living places and doing things in other places. It's only in the past 10 years as I've been traveling as an artist, you know, gathering material and enriching my voice, that I've gone back out and done it like this in a new way. And so I'm re-energized as a visitor to the world. You know, artists are the true aliens.
Nice, man. You know,
come from a different planet to learn about this place and to report back.
Cool. Well, on that note, they are notifying that the show's over in a few minutes, so I got to cut out. But it was awesome having you on. Thank you. Thank you for reading your poetry.
Thanks, Brad. This is Connecticut. It's great to hear your voice again.
Thanks. I'm sure that we're trying to, we're both trying to get out back on the road after this horrendous winter and to try to get out there. So,
Well, we'll catch you in New York, maybe up in Boston. I don't know where you're headed next, but let's do something else.
Yeah, definitely will, man. And I'll be talking to you.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks.
Yep. And that was George Wallace. If you want to check out his stuff, like you said, Google George Wallace poetry. If not, he's on my Facebook page. I think he's an outstanding writer. I think he's an outstanding voice. It's probably been one of my more favorite shows. But next week we'll have Brian Fugier. And I'm sure he's going to want to talk about donkeys and kitty cats and stuff. And then the week after, we have Bill Gaynor. So we've got a few cool shows lined up. We only got 2 shows in December because of the holidays and all that. But with the hell ever.